Within the first day's march, they entered a new country, so different that Santen could scarcely believe it was on the same continent. Here the ancient dunes had compacted and consolidated into gentle undulations, and they now supported abundant plant life. Stands of mapani and tall kiat, alternating with almost impenetrable thickets of paper bark, stood tall along the ridges of high ground, where the dunes' crests had weathered and flattened. Occasionally, a giant silver terminalia or a monumental baobab soared 70 feet above the rest of the forest. In the valleys, fields of sweet golden grasses and scattered giraffe acacias with flat tops gave the scene a park-like and cultivated aspect. Here also, in the lowest depressions, the recent rains had been trapped in the shallow waterholes, and the land seemed to hum and seethe with life. Through the yellow grasses fresh tender shoots of delicate green appeared. Gardens of wild flowers, daisies and arum lilies and gladioli, and 50 other varieties which Santen did not recognize, sprang up, as though at a magician's flourish, delighting her with their colours and delicate beauty, and causing her to wonder anew at Africa's prolificness. She picked the blooms and plaited them into necklaces for herself and Hani, and the old woman preened like a bride.
"Oh, I wish I had a mirror to show you how adorable you look," Santen embraced her.
Even from the sky, Africa gave of her abundance. There were flocks of kuela, thick as hiving bees, as they wheeled overhead, shrikes in the undergrowth with chests of purest glowing ruby, sand grouse and francolin fat as domestic chickens, and waterfowl on the brimming waterholes, wild duck and long-legged stilts and gaunt blue heron.
"It's all so beautiful," Santen exulted.
Each day's journey was light and carefree after the hardships of the arid western plains, and when they camped there was the untold luxury of unlimited water and a feast of wild fruits and nuts and game from Owa's snares and arrows. One evening, Owa climbed high into the swollen, fleshy branches of a monstrous baobab and smoked the hive that had inhabited its hollow trunk since his great-grandfather's time and beyond. He came down with a gourd full of thick waxen combs running with dark honey, redolent of the perfume of the yellow acacia blossoms. Each day they met new species of wild animals, sable antelope, black as night, with long scimitar horns that swept back almost to their hindquarters, and Cape buffalo with mournful, drooping heads of massively bossed horn, stinking like herds of domestic cattle.
"They have come down from the big river and the swamps," Owa explained. "They follow the water, and when it dries again, they will go back into the north."
In the night, Santen woke to a new sound, infinitely more fearsome than the yelping of the black-backed jackal or the maniacal screams and sobs of the hyena packs. It was a storm of sound that filled the darkness, rising to an impossible crescendo and then dying away in a series of deep grunts. Santen scrambled out of a little hut and ran to Hani.
"What was that, old grandmother? It is a sound to turn the belly to water."
Santen found she was trembling, and the old woman hugged her.
"Even the bravest of men trembles the first time he hears the roar of the lion," she placated her. "But do not fear, Namchild. Owa has made a charm to protect us. The lion will find other game tonight."
But they crowded close to the fire all the rest of the night, feeding it with fresh logs, and it was obvious that Hani had as little faith in her husband's magical charms as Santen did. The lion pride circled their campsite, keeping at the very limit of the firelight so that Santen caught only an occasional pale flicker of movement amongst the dark, encroaching bushes. But with the dawn, their dreadful chorus receded, as they moved away into the east, and when Owar showed her the huge cat-like pug marks in the soft earth, he was garrulous with relief. Then, on the ninth morning, after they had left the pan of the big white place, they were approaching another waterhole through the open Mopani forests, when ahead of them there was a crack like a shot of cannon, and they all froze.
"What is it, honey?"
But she waved Sun Tan to silence, and now she heard the crackle of breaking undergrowth, and then suddenly a ringing blast of sound clear as a trumpet call. Quickly, Owa tested the wind as Sun Tan had seen him do at the beginning of every hunt, and then he led them in a wide, stealthy circuit through the forest until he stopped again beneath the spreading, glossy green foliage of a tall Mopani tree, where he laid aside his weapons and his pack. "Come!" he signalled to Sun Tan, and, swiftly as a monkey, shinned up the trunk. Hardly hampered at all by her fruitful belly, Sun Tan followed him into the tree and from a fork in the top branches looked down into the valley of grassland beyond and the waterhole that it contained in its shallow bottom.
"Elephant!"
She recognised the huge grey beasts instantly. They were streaming down the far slope of the valley towards the water, striding out with their ponderous rolling gait, heads swinging so that their enormous ears flapped and their trunks rolling and reaching reflexively as they anticipated the sweet taste of water. They were rangy old queens with tattered earlobes and the knuckles of their spines sticking out of their gaunt backs, young bulls with yellow ivories, tuskless youngsters, boisterous unweaned calves running to keep up with their dams, and at their head the herd bull strode majestically. He stood over 10 feet tall at the shoulder, and he was scarred and grey, thick, baggy skin hanging from his knees and bunched between his back legs. His ears were spread like the mainsail of a tall ship, and his tusks were twice as long and thick as any of his lesser bulls. He seemed aged and yet ageless, huge and rugged, possessed of a grandeur and mystery which seemed to Sun Tan to contain the very essence of this land.